Welcome back to Active Ingredients, the leadership series for people who build, scale, and shape the future of life sciences. I'm your host, Tom Dove, founder and CEO of Fraser Dove International, the life science talent consultancy. Today's guest is Tom Wilson, a leader who's lived every link in the value chain, from elite manufacturing and supply roles over a 30-year career at Pfizer to his current role as chief commercial officer within the global peptide CDMO world at AmbioPharm. Tom brings a rare perspective, one that fuses operational fluency with authentic commercial leadership. But this isn't a story about climbing the ladder. It's a story about selling what you love, leading without ego, and keeping the flame lit on those hard days. Tom believes deeply in the products he sells because he's built them. And that belief fuels everything from his patient-first mindset to his servant leadership style. In today's episode, we explore the shift from tech ops to commercial, the mentors who shaped his future, and how to build teams where people are empowered, trusted, and expected to win. Tom, welcome to Active Ingredients.
Good morning, Tom. Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
No worries. So obviously, we've spoken quite a bit. You've spoken to a few of the people in my team. I love your career arc, and I'm excited to get into this one. But we always start the Active Ingredients podcast with the same question. What do you think are the three key ingredients of a successful leader and why?
Wow, that's not small. The first is you have to have a mission, right? You got to know what your game plan is, right? What is it that gets you moving? The second is you have to work for your people. You've got to put your people in a position where they can win. They've got to have a fighting chance, right? And I've seen the opposite happen. So that is why that's really important to me. And I think the third critical aspect is always be that honest voice around a situation, right? It's when your leadership is always tested in situations. So to be that honest voice, to assess it, to understand it, to really put parameters around it, because you can't solve a problem until you've defined it properly.
Love that. Yes. So mission, know your game plan, work for your people, giving them a fighting chance, and being that honest voice.
Yep, that works.
Love it. So before we get into the episode, where those leadership values are probably going to permeate through a lot of what you speak about, I wanted to understand, before you got into the industry, like, what was your early life like? Were there any signposts or directions that maybe you might have a career in life sciences across all of that value chain? What were you like at university? What was Tom like then?
So, actually, this was not the plan. When I was growing up, I wanted to join the military, and it was still the Cold War. It's still the NATO team facing off against the Warsaw Pact team. I studied physics and engineering at university with the goal of becoming an officer in the United States Air Force. I was successful at that. Joined the Air Force just in time for the Cold War to come to an end. So it became a challenge for the military to stay as large as it was. So there were opportunities to move on and try something else. What I did at that time, and again, this is, pre-iPads, pre-laptops, pre-desktops, there were these things called books. So there was a book that came out, back then. It was called What Color Is Your Parachute? And it was a series of guided exercises for you to tackle personally, to try and understand what lit your fire, what really got you motivated. And as I went through those exercises, it immediately became apparent that my driving desire my need to be a leader would fit very well in the manufacturing space. Or as a farmer, and I didn't see myself as a farmer, but the manufacturing space. And then as I continued to do the exercises, it was manufacturing that could make a contribution to people, right? That would do good, that could really help. And that's what led to the life sciences. So from there, I built a campaign to take on the life sciences world and try and find a role within the life sciences world. And I was lucky enough to land an opportunity as a frontline supervisor at Aerst Laboratories, which became Wyeth Aerst, which became Wyeth, which became Pfizer. But it was just a great opportunity space. And honestly, when I got there, when I found that home, I had interviewed with some folks at SmithKline Beecham. And they said, listen, we understand you have an opportunity at Aerst. Go do that for 2 years and then you can come work here in a real pharmaceutical company. And the reason they said that is Aerst was part of American Home Products. So it was, you know, there was pharmaceuticals, there was consumer healthcare with like Advil and Robitussin. But there, you know, there was also Brock's Candies and Echo Pots and Pans and animal feed. It's just a whole bunch of stuff. But in those 2 years that I was there, all those businesses got divested and the company really focused in on pharmaceuticals. So I, you know, the same as I was in the military for a change and a downsizing and a shrinkage, I was in Aerst as Wyeth really found its path and became a real competitive pharmaceutical company.
Yeah, brilliant. And it's quite interesting that you had such a vision or the support from What Color Is Your Parachute to really hone in that this is what I want to do, because a lot of people are still slightly unsure at that point and don't have the absolute pathway. So how important was that book? I mean, I've never heard of this before.
No, it really was fantastic. I'm sure there's other things out there today, but it really gets into trying to understand what motivates you, what drives you. And the exercises really help explore that. And the exercises aren't something that you just sit and you know, it's a quick fill in the dot test. It requires and guides you through research to do. And again, back then, it was books. You had to go to the library. Yeah. You know, the research would be a lot easier to perform today. But really, it did help unlock thought patterns that I'd not had before. Because, again, I was coming from a military career. I was coming from, you know, being in aviation. So it was really, I'd never even considered any of that before. So it was like unlocking a whole new world to me. Now, truth be told, my family comes from a background in McNeil Laboratories, right? So my family knew Tylenol. My family, you know, knew all the things that McNeil generated. But that was never my career path.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think that self-awareness of finding, you know, what it is that you want from a career, that often happens quite a lot later once you've had a few different roles. But for you, it's kind of 5 years military and then boom, into the career that you're then going to stay in for the next 30 odd years.
Right, exactly. Just crazy. Never in a million years did I pick this pathway.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's so good. So, you know, at that point when you've come in, how different, how wildly different was it moving into the corporate world? How did you adjust?
So 9 to 5 was really different, right? And it really wasn't 9 to 5, right? I was a manufacturing supervisor. So it was, you know, right from the get-go, it's 10-hour days. You got to get there an hour before your shift to make sure you've got everything figured out. You're staying an hour after your shift to make sure everything's transitioned over to the second shift guys or the third shift guys, wherever you are. So that was different, right? Because I was used to, you know, 12-hour shifts in a command capsule or 24-hour shifts in a command capsule, but not being active that whole time, right? Because you're just sitting there waiting for the balloon to go up. Probably that phrase doesn't resonate anymore. Anyway, I'm old. but so really trying to understand that, Understand working in a union environment, right? Where, again, in the military, everybody's pulling together in the same direction. In the union environment, it was very much about work rules, what has to be done. Expected to find manufacturing efficiencies all the time, right? If you're not improving, you're dying, right? So that was really important to, you know, pull that logic in. And then being in a GMP environment. Now that was familiar to me, right? So in the military, I was part of an organization called Strategic Air Command, which was responsible for nuclear weapons, right? So there, everything was standard operating procedures, checklists, doing everything the right way every time, no deviation. Working in GMP, that was the same way, right? Standard operating procedures, batch records, you know, you got to make sure you do everything the right way every single time. And then when something goes wrong, you got to figure it out pretty darn quick, right? Because you got to get the line back up and running and, you know, people are counting on you.
Yeah, it's nice that there's definitely some kind of, you know, from one part to the next, a couple of things that you can take from your previous career into the new one, but also there seems to be some purpose throughout what you've chosen to do twice. You know, you've wanted to join the military at that point of the Cold War, as you say, just before it ended, but then you've also wanted to come in from a purpose-led standpoint into the life sciences. So that's definitely a theme that I'm keen to talk about a little bit later on. But what about, you know, leadership? When did you first feel that you were in a leadership role?
Funny. So I was thinking about that after, you know, we had talked previously, and I really think it goes back to when I was quite young, right? So I was in the Boy Scouts, right? The American Boy Scouts. And I was sent on a leadership retreat. And there was this, the original activity was, you know, we were divided into teams and told to just go set up a campsite, right, and get everything situated. And it was later that I learned that it was supposed to be a leaderless experience, right, and all the problems that come with not having proper leadership. And I screwed it all up for them, because when we got there, you know, when I realized that there was nobody stepping up, it's like, okay, I just kind of command, right? And just you do this, let's map out how we're going to lay out this campsite, let's, you know, we'll do the fire pit over here, the cooking area, cooking prep area over here, we'll put the tents there, you know. And it just came naturally to me, right? Just that ability to see what could be or what needs to be and then make that happen.
Love it. So it was always within you.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's always been like my driving motivation, right? It's you know, I like to say I some people can see the dots. I see how to connect the dots, right? And it's connecting the dots that really just lights my fire.
Yeah, love it. And what lessons when you think of actually, you know, coming into a corporate world and feeling like a leader in that example, were there any early lessons that you got from like your first corporate leadership role that then, you know, stood the test of time for years to come?
Yeah, you know, one that I reflect on, and it bothered the heck out of me at the time, but now I see why it was so important. Sometimes you need to lose to win, right? So again, I started in a union shop, and every time that a grievance was brought, you know, against me or against my work area, whatever, I won every grievance, right? And it just infuriated the union leadership, right? I always had a sound basis in everything I did. It was always logic. It was always actually within the work rules, right? I knew the work rules. I knew the contract inside out. And I remember being called into the HR area, and they're like, they're gonna issue a grievance on this. You need to lose. They need to get a win. You got to get them to calm down, right? And I could see the fallacy in their arguments. I could see the fallacy in their grievance, and it killed me to take the loss. But now looking back on that, there's plenty of instances after that where I took the loss because for the betterment of the culture, people have to feel like, you know, they've been successful as well, right? And it can't always be confrontational, right? There's got to be a give and take. And I think that was a key early lesson, right? That, you know, just because you're right doesn't mean it's right.
Yeah. And being able to then take that lose to win mentality throughout your career. Now we get to talk about the exciting part of your career arc, because you are now in a situation where, I mean, you and I have spoken about this. You've come back into the game, into the CDMO world, to sell what you love.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk a little bit about that and all those foundational steps that then have got you to this point?
Sure. Sure. It's, you know, if we go back and look at, you know, I started out manufacturing. You know, I went through the exercises, manufacturing, the ability to convert raw materials into something usable just fascinates me. To this day, it fascinates me. I mean, one of the very first products I worked on was a product called Premarin. So it was a hormone replacement therapy for folks. That product is, you know, is derived from pregnant mare's urine. That's where the name comes from, Premarin, pregnant mare's urine. We collect the urine from pregnant horse mares and convert it into a medication that was at its peak a $4 billion a year product, right? I mean, that's pretty remarkable, right? Another product was based on the oil that's derived from the sands of Easter Island. Right, that's the only place you can find it is the sand on Easter Island. Just astounding, you know, the ability to convert that. So you know, starting from that background of conversion, moving up through the opportunity space. So the plant that I started at in upstate New York was a multi capability plant, right? So solid oral dose, sterile injectables, liquids, creams, and ointments, APIs. The ability to do lots of different products, servicing lots of different business lines. And we would move through the various operations, either at a 6-month point, 12-month point, or 18-month point, right, to be able to learn the broader bit of business, right? So I really had the opportunity to learn a lot about how pharmaceuticals are made, different drug product formats, not as broadly on the API side, but still some. But it was a really a great learning opportunity. From there, that was the era when a lot of manufacturing was moving to Europe in general and Ireland very specifically. So everybody wanted an Irish assignment. At the same time, we were just getting a beachhead going in Singapore. And it was like, okay, if everybody's going to Europe, I want to go somewhere different. I'm going to go to Singapore, right? So. Helped establish a plant in Singapore, right? And really learn what it took to build a plant, what it took to start up a plant. That was all just great learning, right? Brand new plant, you think, oh, you just turn it on and everything works. Yeah, right, sure.
Yeah.
Turn it on and find out what doesn't work.
Well, yeah.
You know, but coming back from that and then working in manufacturing strategy, really understanding the business practices behind how plants work, how and when to expand a plant, how and when to contract a plant, how and when to close or sell a plant. Really trying to get all that experience. That then led to an opportunity presented to me by two people that became mentors for me. One was Bill Brooks, who had been the site leader at the Rouse's Point New York plant, but was now leading strategy for Wyeth Consumer Healthcare. And then Peter Bigelow. And you know, if folks on here know life sciences, they know Peter Bigelow. Everybody knows Peter Bigelow. But you know, Peter, very early influence for me, and I'm just blessed to having known both of those gentlemen. They challenged me to work with the outsourcing operation in Wyeth Consumer Healthcare to understand how to convert that business from a procurement-based model to an engagement-based model, right? To actually not just issue purchase orders to CDMOs and hope that the product shows up, but to start to really engage with them, understand what it takes to get that level of service that we wanted, to get the level of buy-in and opportunity from the CDMOs. And to do that, it took a two-way street. It took building a relationship. So that was the whole basis of engagement. They had me work with the two godfathers of the engagement model within the pharma space, people that would pop up throughout my career going forward. So it was Jim Ryder at J&J and Pete Stevenson over at Pharmacia, right? So a chance to work with both of them and learn from them as to how they did engagement. And it was great, right? It was building a virtual plant, and we had not thought about that, but really building that virtual plant. You know, we had a supply chain, we had a quality organization, we had tech services, you know, everything except janitors and landscapers, right? I mean, we had everything else because we had to bring that product in, and we were able to move products, from Gen 1 to Gen 2 to Gen 3, which we had never been successful at doing before, right? Really getting those improvements in terms of improving the formulas. We were able to improve our OTIFs. We were able to improve our cost structures. It was just a win across the board. But it really took that engagement and working with the CDMOs themselves to understand what was possible for them and what they needed, right? And to try and find that Venn diagram, right? Where could we find that mutual opportunity space that we would both benefit from? But to do that, you got to build a relationship, right? And that was my first exposure to the virtual market and how the virtual market works. So that, again, that was a huge opportunity. And that was actually it was fascinating, right? I had run, you know, brick and mortar plants, right? And running a virtual plant, I thought would be radically different. And it actually wasn't, you know, it's still the same thing. It's still conversion. It's still getting the product in and out of the door. It's just, you know, you have remote work centers instead of everything being under a singular roof. Right. And that was the way that we thought of it, was remote work centers. I think the other thing that we did there, and this really started to connect dots for me, and I had thought about it before, but we found through that engagement model that the more that we worked with the CDMOs, the more they needed to understand who our patients were, the more they needed to understand the impact that they were making on a line of business, right? So going into a facility, a CDMO in South Florida, to talk about Advil liquid gels, right? And here's the patients that you're impacting. And I don't know that anybody had talked to them before about, you know, to them it was just, you know, they're turning out widgets. And it's like, nah, you're actually helping patients. You know, yes, it's an over-the-counter product, but you all go into the store all the time. You see that Advil on the shelf. You made that difference, right? And really helping them understand that. That then led to the opportunity to go over to Wyeth Pharma. And in Wyeth Pharma, there had been some challenges, some leadership challenges, and there was a need to build out a brand new leadership structure over there. So that was where I got a chance to work with Lou Schmuckler, who went on to become the president of manufacturing for Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Sanat Chattopadhyay, who is still the president of manufacturing at Merck Sharp & Dohme. Right. So again, working, I've just been blessed with working with great leaders who've gone on to you know, amazing roles throughout the industry to make a difference every day. But working there, we did. Working there, I was responsible not just for the plant structure and the supply structure, but we had created what we called strategic portfolio leaders. And what we found was, okay, so if we go back to connecting dots, right? Connecting the dot with the CDMOs is what I did in consumer healthcare. Here, where we had not effectively connected the dots was with the business, right? We were a silo within manufacturing, right? The demand signal comes in, you produce the product, you send it out with the appropriate supply indication, right? I mean, it's S&OP, right? You know, I love when people say, well, we don't have an S&OP. It's like everybody has an S&OP. You get a demand signal, you put product out the door. You might not call it S&OP, but it's an S&OP. But what we were not doing was interacting with the business to understand where they were going. What were their strategies? How could we enable those strategies? Where were their strategies not viable because we couldn't make what they wanted made? Perfect example of this was there was a game plan for a blister card product where they wanted the product brand up in every single card and angled in exactly the same way. So when you looked at the blister card, the tablet's in there and it's perfectly branded and it stands up all the way across. It's like, if you want to do that, we're going to be doing that manually. There's no way to automate. Well, at the time there wasn't a way to automate it. We could have gone down this horrible road. And we did go down a horrible road on another product. We were making an oral contraceptive. And they had this state-of-the-art dispenser, right? Instead of the typical racetrack blister card or the dial, it was like a Pez dispenser. It was 17 working parts, 3 springs. And it was just trying to get this thing to work was darn near impossible. And what we tried to explain to them is, guys, we don't have mechanical engineers on staff. We're not mechanical engineers. We don't work in the device space. We're pharma guys, you know, mm-hmm. chemists, biologists, microbiologists, you know, the weird physicists like me. But yeah, it just trying to understand it. But again, connecting that dot with the commercial team. I think that was really important. And then Pfizer bought us, right? So working with Pfizer, working on plant rationalizations. When Pfizer acquired Wyeth, Pfizer had, I want to say it was 139 plants around the world, right? I mean, just this massive number of plants.
Wild.
Just to put that in perspective, today Pfizer, I believe, is 35 plants around the world. Right, and they've done several more acquisitions since then, but it was a chance of rationalizing, harmonizing, really focusing on what was important. So really working on that, working on the business cases for that. After that, there was an effort on the part of Pfizer to get into the generic space. There was the thinking that, you know. And it was driven by manufacturing for Pfizer products. And it started with the products lose exclusivity right when we've optimized that cost to the maximum extent possible, right? We know the product. We know the challenges with making it. We know how to make it cheap. We're Gen 2, Gen 3, sometimes Gen 6, right? I mean, Lipitor, we were Gen 6 when that lost exclusivity. We knew how to make those, and we did, and we were competitive for the Pfizer intellectual property getting out there. And then ego got in the way, right? So yes. Pfizer then considered, well, if we're this successful with our products, we can be successful with any product, right? So they started buying in products from companies that were doing the reverse engineering. And companies, you know, well known in the space, you know, Aurobindo, Zydus, you know, really good generics houses, right? So we were buying the marketing authorizations for those. There needed to be a manufacturing interface, and that was the role that I got. So what was really interesting about that was where Pete Stevenson circled back into my life, right? So when yep. I had worked with Pete in Wyeth Consumer Healthcare, now Pete was running that supply arm. Right. So I got hired by Pete to be able to be that manufacturing interface to help us realize the value proposition associated with bringing those generics in and for us to sell those generics in the open market. It cost us $2 billion to buy our way into that marketplace, and it cost us another $1 billion 2 years later to buy our way out of that marketplace. We didn't understand it. We didn't understand the marketplace. We thought we did. What we actually understood was where Pfizer competed with Pfizer products that we had that long history with, that we really knew those products intimately. What we didn't understand was the nature of the generic market, the nature of tenders, and how to really be successful at tenders, how to get 3 month, 6 month, 9 month contracts, and how to set aside the need to have a perfect OTIF, right? So in the generic space, to be successful, you sell what you have. You don't sell it and then make it and then push it out the door. You don't have that kind of time. You know, the cycle time on manufacturing is 3, 6, 9 months.
Yeah.
And vaccines can be 2 years, right? So it was just trying to hit that. So that was a bit of a challenge. And like I said, it just wasn't something that we were designed for, right? It wasn't the design structure that we had. So a lot of other small roles came up in there. But then the role that really clicked for me, and this was the last 10 years of my career, and by far the most fun I have ever had in manufacturing. And again, a pathway that I never would have envisioned. But Pfizer acquired Hospira, so the old Abbott hospital business.
Yep.
And again, the goal here was to really play hard in the generic space, but in a space we understood, which was working with hospitals, working with you know, really difficult to make sterile injectable generic products, right? And Hospira had huge command of that space. Hospira also had this small arm off to the side called Hospira 1-to-1, which was Hospira's CDMO operation for sterile injectables. Now, what I don't know was necessarily completely understood by Pfizer at the time was that that was actually the strategic business line for Hospira. Their margins were double what the generic margins were for the products that Hospira was making for the generic marketplace. We took that, and then Pfizer had what was called Pfizer Center Source. So Pfizer was selling, and I'm sure everybody's been around for a while shaking their head because we all bought from Pfizer Center Source. I bought from Pfizer Center Source. But legacy APIs, primarily from the Upjohn business that were sold on the open market. You put that business, that Pfizer Center Source business, together with 1-to-1, suddenly you have a very competitive CDMO. Right. And we did. We had a $350 million business. Right. That's a pretty good line of business. You know, it's not inconsequential. So Pete Stevenson knocked on my door again. Right. That needed a manufacturing lead. Now, so the vision here was to take the excess capacity at various Pfizer sites that had value and broker that in the open marketplace. So they needed a manufacturing interface because, you know, Pfizer, what became Pfizer Center One, you know, the new CDMO, did not have its own plants, didn't even have its own work centers, right? So it was really a brokerage operation to unleash the, you know, at the time they thought it was the capacities of the products. And that was the original vision. So I came in as the manufacturing lead to be the manufacturing interface for all the plants, right? And we ended up working with almost every plant within the Pfizer network, having operations. But what was interesting was when I came into that, I came into that with the experience as a buyer, right? I was moving into the selling side of the house, but I came in as a buyer. And I could immediately see the first challenge, which was the positioning was we're selling capacity. And it's like, yeah, so is everybody else. And frankly, it's not like when I was buying access to stainless. The stainless is the stainless. Everybody has stainless. I needed the people. I needed your talent pool to be able to make things. I needed your capability, not your capacity. right? And that was a pivot. And the more I banged that drum, the more I found I was moving from just being the manufacturing interface to actually working with existing client partners and then getting introduced to potential client partners. And I found myself selling. Yeah. And I had, I'm a knuckle dragon production guy. What the hell am I doing selling? But that's what happened. And it's because I had developed that deep knowledge base of manufacturing and I loved everything I did about it. Right. I mean, I really, really lit my fire to make product. And I realized that these people are just trying to get their product made. Right. So how do I convey that to them? How do I do that? And that's what led to my transition to selling. Right. So it was, again, I was the manufacturing guy, but I was able to talk their language. I was able to break it down and make it very simple and understand what they were looking for. And then when Pete retired, the new leader asked me, and that's Joelle Silva, again, well-known name in the CDMO space now. But she asked me to become her commercial lead. Right. So that's what I did. And I suddenly became a commercial lead. It's selling what I love, though, right? So, I mean, it's really easy to do that. And having that background, I could have a conversation with people that were looking for something in the API space, something in the biologic space, something in small molecule solids, sterile injectables, because I'd done it all.
Yeah. When you look back at all of those, pivots, changes, tweaks, the moves to different countries, the moves across varying roles within product, manufacturing, supply, that foundation of knowledge is absolutely paramount. But then if you can also, as you said earlier, connect the dots and build relationships, mm-hmm. you've got the perfect, CDMO commercial mindset.
Yeah, except for one big transition, right? So it's and the big transition is putting yourself in the proper role. So when you're responsible for the manufacturing, when you're on the buy side, you've got that accountability, right? You've also got the bucket of money, but you've got that accountability. You're responsible for that supply for your company, and that's your company's revenue stream. When you're the CDMO, your revenue stream is just the conversion, right? So it's understanding that once I moved into the CDMO space, I was no longer the superhero, right? I was the sidekick, but choosing to be the right sidekick, right? So for the longest time, we used to say the customer's Batman and we're Robin, and it just it always kind of bothered me a little bit because, Robin always found himself getting into trouble, right? He was always captured by the bad guy, always did something stupid that Batman had to unwind. And I've reconsidered it now. It's the customer's still Batman, but I like to think that we're Alfred, right? We're behind the scenes trying to make sure that everything works right, that the tools work right. Batman has everything he needs to save the day. Right. And that's what we need to do for the customers. Right. We need to be Alfred to their Batman.
Love that.
But not being the superhero anymore, that's a challenge. Right. And I find that when we get people in the CDMO space, especially when they come from one of the big pharma companies, one of the MNCs, sometimes they just can't let go of the superhero thing. Right. And they can't be successful here. Right. It's that ability to recognize where you fit in the value chain. I think that's really important. And that goes back to like I said, ego, right? Your ego can get in the way. But the other thing is you got to find that common ground, right? That Venn diagram with the customer. And for us in CenterOne, for us in Ambio Farm, and for me personally, I have found that common ground is always recognizing that there's a patient at the end of everything you do, right? There's a lot easier ways to make money than pharma. There's a lot easier ways to do it. I mean, if this was easy, everybody would do it, right? It'd be Joe's Tire Emporium and pharmaceutical manufacturing, right? Not that there's anything wrong with tires, but it's just, it's a bear, right? The rules are onerous. the interpretation of the rules are amorphous, right? And just the science is so cutting edge that, you know, the trick to cutting edge is you end up bleeding, right? So it's really being out there. But if you recognize that patients are counting on you every single day, what you do makes a difference, not just in one person's life, but in the life of their family as well. That's a heady responsibility. That gets you motivated to solve problems, to fix things and get it out the door, right? Instead of just saying, oh, well.
I was speaking to a CDMO leader who actually said in one of their big sites, and this is only recently, they've gone from taking down the quotes from Albert Einstein or Michael Jordan, you know, almost sort of commercial-based quotations on walls, and replacing them with things that patients have said or pictures of patients or things along those lines. And that's recently, that's within the last 12 to 18 months that this has happened in an extremely large CDMO. So it's quite interesting that you have always had that patient centricity, and we've spoken about finding the purpose on those hard days. Can we talk about that a little bit more and how important that is to you?
So that's what motivated me. I mean, even when I retired from Pfizer, it was like, okay, I might go back. I might do board membership here or, you know, do some consulting there and, you know, just kind of, you know, take the easy path. And then I started talking to Brian Gregg and Steve Keel at AmbioPharm, and it was like, and then I realized, yeah, I'm not done helping patients yet. It's like I can still make a difference here, and I can make a difference with products that, you know, they're just coming into their heyday in peptides. And peptide as a concept have been around for a very long time. But with the success that Novo and Lilly have had recently, it's gotten a lot of people looking at them, right? So there's a lot of new opportunities in this space, and it's like, I can bring value here by helping people understand how to be successful in this space and to help AmbioPharm, you know, be a real contributor in the marketplace and make a difference, right? And it's, you know, helping that team there get ready. But that's, it's all driven by, I still had more that I could do for patients, right? And even when I left Pfizer, it was making sure that before I left, that the people that were still there understood that there were patients at the end of everything, right? And for anybody on this line that knows Jenny Guattari, who's running, you know, the commercial arm of Pfizer Center One now, Jenny Guattari is all about the patient, right? And that's what she wants to, the first thing she's going to ask a client partner when she meets them, who are your patients? What's their journey? How can we help? Right. And that's the same thing that I do. That's the same thing that somebody like Dave Powell at Grand River does. It's, you know, that's what gets us going. Right. It's, you know, there's so many things you could say. This science is suboptimal. We just need to, you know, give up on this and move somewhere else. And it's like that science, people are depending on it. You can't just give up and walk away. Yeah. Okay. So the product might not have been fully developed yet. That's why you have Gen 2. That's why you have Gen 3, right? The first thing is get the product out there as fast as you can so that you can start to treat the patients that need it, right? That, you know, the manufacturing, you muddle through. Gen 2, you start to clean up the manufacturing, right? And that helps you reduce your cycle times. That helps you improve your cost position, which means the product can be more cost competitive in the marketplace. Those are all good things. They're all higher aspirations, but everything's driven by a patient and the patient need. But you talk about the pictures, man, I got to tell you the best thing I've ever seen. And it's the president of Pfizer manufacturing today, Mike McDermott. Mike was challenged with fixing a plant in Pearl River, New York. It was on consent decree. And they were really struggling. They were making Prevnar, which is a pneumococcal vaccine for infants, right? What he did was have the employees bring in pictures of their children, of their grandchildren, of their nieces and nephews, posted them everywhere. I said, this is who we're working for. That plant came out of consent decree probably faster than any plant has ever come out of a consent decree because those people realized what they were doing. That gave them the buy-in to make that cultural change, to do things to meet the and exceed the expectation of the regulators.
And have you had examples where perhaps, you know, a team that you've brought together or that you've been parachuted in to lead maybe hasn't had a purposeful patient-centric leader? How do you help teams find their own version of that flame?
So we're actually doing that right here, right now, right? So within the peptide space, you have it's been an insulated part of the pharma landscape for decades, right? It's hard science. It's really challenging. Oh, it's amazing though what can be done, particularly synthetics. But it's been, you know, a very well-defined customer segment, a very well-defined CDMO segment, and everybody knows everybody. With the success of Novo and Lilly, you've got people coming into the space now that have not traditionally been in the peptide space, right? So, you know, we've met with various companies that, you know, well-known companies, but they're just now trying to figure out what can they do in the peptide space. So helping the team here recognize that, you know, it's not just about the cool science of taking amino acids and assembling a peptide. And it is cool science, but it's also recognizing that there's patients at the end of this, and the customers that we're dealing with now are not the traditional peptide customers. So they're much more used to what is now the regular standard of the CDMO industry, which is, you know, who are your patients? How do you work? How do you serve them? That expectation is coming into this market, and we've got to be ready for that. So we talk about that, right? But it's introducing new selling styles, introducing new ways of approaching a conversation, of approaching, doing a proposal, of approaching, just initial outreach, that first call, right? Strategizing on the first call. It's having a different conversation, having a conversation that has an emotional component, not simply a science component, and building those connections, building that emotional connection to the client, as opposed to just a technical connection. It is different, right? And there are people who adopt it very readily and very quickly. And there are people that are like, that's not how we do things, right? So helping them get comfortable with it, helping them understand the value prop, demonstrating it, allowing them to space to find their own authentic way of doing it, right? So not everybody's going to do it the way I do it. Now, I'm off the charts, right? I'm a true believer. I'm that scary spear carrier that just really, I get out of bed in the morning because I can help patients. Right.
Yeah.
I've seen people do the act, right? And I can tell when they're not authentic, but I get a little bit ahead of myself. But that's okay, because that's who I am. But I want people to figure out who they are, right? And be able to express that, you know, in an authentic way for themselves. And that's giving them space to do trial and error. That's giving them space to ask questions, giving them space to really flesh it out. But I think the other thing there is you have to build a team that complements each other, right? So one of the things that I found over time is you don't want a team of cookie cutter people, right? If everybody's the same, then you're not going to be able to backstop one another. You're definitely not going to see common blind spots, right? To be able to solve for that. So that, I mean, that's another aspect of that is that you want a team that different people bring, not just different technical skills to the team, but different emotional skills, emotional content to the team, different ways of approaching a challenge. I like to use Herman Brain. There's other people like to use DISC, but really trying to make sure that you've built that team around different people's skill sets. And then what you get there is different perspectives on patient centricity. And those different perspectives allow space for people to find their authentic approach to that. Right. So again, I'm a Herman Brain guy. Right. So it's blue, green, yellow, red. Right. And I'm very yellow. Right. So I'm very much in that leadership and strategic focus space. I always like to find reds. Right. The people that are, you know, the bleeding hearts. Right. You really need those bleeding hearts because they can help you understand the patient journey. They can help you understand the journey the patient's family goes on. Right. And, you know, that's important. But the blues and greens figure out how to get things done and how to get things there. Right. But again, doesn't mean that they're not emotional. Everybody has red. Everybody has yellow. Everybody has blue. Everybody has green. How do you bring that out? How do you make them comfortable with expressing themselves in that? And that's a lot of what we have to do, right? Is create that space for people, right? It's, you know, we've had a conversation about servant leadership. That I think is what my job is now, right? My job has been that since, I guess when I got promoted to vice president the first time, right? It was understanding that I was no longer a leader of people. I was a leader of leaders, right? And having to make sure that those leaders had what they needed to be successful. I had to be a servant to them. Right. Making sure that they, because they were leading the frontline organization, right. Making sure that they had what they needed to be successful and not just physically have what they needed, but mentally, did we have them in a good place? Had we prepared them? Had we trained them well? Were we giving them space to fail and get the lessons from failure? Were we giving them a celebration for success? Right. All of those aspects that was really important too. And it's the same thing I'm finding here, right? It's servant leadership here. My job wasn't to come in here and just say, okay, we're going to do everything different. We're going to change everything. We're going to blow it all up. You guys have done everything wrong. Absolutely not. I've seen that done before. It's a nightmare. You know, the people that do that should be ashamed of themselves, right? It's more a case of figuring out, okay, what's working, what's not working. Sit down and talk to people for a while. Try and find out where their hot buttons are. You know, but where have they been successful too? And then start to build around that, you know, build around the success and then try and make their lives easier on what's stressful. Right. And those are all things that help get an organization moving in the same direction.
Yeah. And it seems like now you've got to this point where, I mean, these are two big topics. Okay. So you've got servant leadership. And I know that you've called it the like ultimate leadership and coaching framework. But you learned that from a mentor. Now it's your turn. It seems like you're paying forward as well. So you're now in the mentorship of servant leadership. So can we talk about those two aspects? Who taught you it and why do you think it's so important?
So if we go back, I mean, it's, I would say four leaders have really played a massive role in my life, right? So Bill Brooks, who was in and out of my life multiple times, my professional life multiple times, personal life too, but in and out multiple times. He passed away some years ago. I miss him every day. There's so many times I just want to pick up the phone and call him and say, I'm facing this. Then there's Peter Bigla, as I said. So Pete Stevenson, and then Joel Silva. Right. So all of them demonstrated. I mean, it wasn't just that they talked about servant leadership. They walked the talk. Right. And it was, you know, the first time I met Bill, he was the site leader in New York State at the New York plant and just supporting us as frontline supervisors. Right. And what did we need to be successful on the shop floor? And then getting those things. We had not had that before he came in. Before he came in, it was still like 1960s leadership there, right? It was Mad Men, right? Those guys in the front area, you didn't go up there. And you know, that was the holy of holies, the inner sanctum up there where great decisions were made. Bill was very open. He was out on the shop floor. He'd walk the floor, you know, understanding what was going on. That was, you know, leadership by walking around, right? That was the first time I'd seen that done. Peter I was working on a product that we had insufficient capacity. It was Effexor XR, so an SSRI, and we just did not have enough capacity. And he was like, "I need some weird ideas. Give me some weird ideas." I remember we were touring the facilities, like, "Give me some weird ideas," and we bounced a weird idea off him. He said, "What do you need to make that happen?" And we it got us everything we needed to make it happen. It was like, okay, and we did something radical to relieve that capacity pressure, right? And to be more successful and be able to turn out the amount of product that was required. Again, it was that enabling step. And then the two of them throughout the rest of my Wyeth time, constantly putting themselves in a position where they could support people, right? And they were demonstrating servant leadership. It wasn't just talking about it, they were demonstrating it. And they were teaching us, right? And they were teaching me how to do that, right? So when I had people in that virtual plant reporting to me, I remember both of them pulling me aside at different points and saying, think about doing it this way. Think about, you know, asking them what to do. Think about listening more and talking less, which you're probably laughing at because I'm here. I am talking. Those were important lessons. And then with Pete, in Pfizer, it was really trying to understand, particularly during my time in Bangalore and Hyderabad, how those companies thought about manufacturing and supply and demand signals. And that was a real learning, right? I mean, they didn't look at things the way we looked at things. We looked at, you know, 12-month, 18-month demand signal forecasts. Those guys were acting with like 7 days lead time, right? It was just radical. But it was like, suspend everything that you thought you knew. You need to suspend that, Tom. You need to really just observe, listen, and see how they tackle this. Where do they find the shortcuts to understanding, to be able to react quickly, right? How do they cut through? He didn't use this term, somebody else used it, but how do they cut through the noise to get to the signal, right? And that I thought was a real important one. And then Joyelle, where Joyelle was enabling, was really just trying to understand what did people need to be successful, right? And helping me understand, you know, not just where they needed, you know, the technical support or financial support, but Joyelle is going back to Herman Brain, Joyelle is one of the rarest combinations I've ever seen. She's yellow and red. I've never seen that in anybody before, but she was the one that helped me understand where people need it personal. Right? Where do they need space for themselves? Where do they need a bit of quiet time to think? Where do they need time to catch up? Or where do you need to let them just go? You know, that they've got great ideas. Just let them go. Don't get in the way. Just figure out what they need to support them as they're moving along and get them that support. So those were all people that helped me do that. And now it's my job to do that, right? So it's taking not just the folks that I have on the team at AmbioPharm, but there's people throughout the industry that I work with as well. People that express an interest in growing, people that realize that there's no such thing as a straight linear pathway to growth, right? And how do I help them understand what they want to do? So it's you know, I always offer people the opportunity, but the ones that really afford themselves of it, it becomes a question of, okay, what are you hoping to achieve? What do you want to get out of it? What I look for is people that are not focused on that next job title, but are focused on growing one or more specific skill sets. Because then we can really work with that, right? That they want to add tools to their toolkit. That's what opens you up. Because if you're just chasing job title, I've seen people do it, and they always seem to be chasing the same titles, right? And the people that build the skill sets, they're the ones that get the interesting jobs, right? Especially if they've got guts enough to go out to the Wild West, right? And yeah. You know, there's mainstream multinational, right? Which, you know, there's we used to call it Big Pfizer. right? There's big Pfizer, and there's a very strict set of rules as to how you get ahead and how you communicate and how you talk. And then there's the periphery operations, which I've always been out on the periphery operations. And that's where the rules get suspended, because getting the job done is what's important. Right. And finding pathways to get it done and finding pathways to do it affordably. That's where the fun is. And that's where you can really build out those skill sets.
Yeah. And we've spoken, and thank you for sharing your insight there on the servant leadership and the mentoring piece. But it brings us on quite nicely to this next part, where it's like leadership without the ego. How we disagree is as important as what we're disagreeing about. So what have you learned from, you know, that kind of, you've just spoken there about the two worlds within Pfizer. Can you give us an overview of how you try and create non-toxic cultures by speaking openly?
That's easier said than done. So I think the first trick is everybody needs to have permission to disagree, right? Because it's, you've got to create a permission structure for that, right? So, and then you've got to frame how to do it. You've got to teach people you can disagree without being disagreeable, right? And that's really important. Disagreement is where the best ideas come from. Right. But people have to have that freedom to speak up, the freedom to say, hey, I'm not sure I'm buying into that completely. And demonstrating the right words for that. Right. What I find as a senior leader, it's if I can identify not just through what people say, but body language is usually the perfect tell. If I can figure out through body language that they disagree, I will try and pull that out of them. Now, if they're new to me, I might give them a bit of a pathway to take to see how to disagree and be able to put that forward, but without, you know, feeling like they're in jeopardy or that they're jeopardizing anybody else. Right? You can challenge. You just shouldn't create a state of jeopardy. So part of that is to pull some of the ego out of it. Right. So it's stay focused on the topic at hand. Right. And really do that. The other thing is, and this goes back to something that Ian Reed, the former CEO of Pfizer, emphasized with his own it culture. One of the parts of his own it culture was adopting the there's a book out there. There's also a whole video series called the No Asshole Rule. Right. Our head of HR was like, you can't use that, Ian. So it ended up becoming the no jerks rule in Pfizer. But it's all based on that book, and it's a great book. But it really talks about the fact that people that are disagreeable, yes, they can add value. But at the end of the day, they're a net drain on an organization, right? They put stresses and costs on the organization that could be solved with the same amount of disagreement without being disagreeable. Right. So it's, Joyelle would say the juice is not worth the squeeze, but it's trying to not let somebody do that. Don't let them go down that rabbit hole. Stay focused on on the topic at hand, right? Here's the topic. Let's not personalize the topic. Let's just stay focused on the topic and let's beat up different ways that we can solve the challenge in front of us, or that we can tackle the strategy that we need to execute, right? There's lots of ways to do it. Let's explore a bunch of them. The other technique that I like to tell people is you actually have agency in everything that you do. So, and this is really important for people who can go down the wrong road, right? So it's like, what I want you to do, instead of just reacting immediately, I want you to think of three possible reactions. And it's only going to take you a second or two, but think of three different ways that you can react to a statement and then consciously pick one. Don't let your id pick your reaction. You know, go after make your own choice. You are your own agent. Make your own choice. But you really take that moment and think through three different things. And even if all three are terrible,
at least you look thoughtful because you stopped and thought for a moment, right? And you know, it's maybe you can't come up with three. You still look thoughtful. You look really smart. So, you know, there's a real benefit to that. I like to call it the practice of three.
Nice. I like that. That's definitely something that we can use. On going back to one of those statements that you said earlier, though, imagine you're in a room, you're seeing somebody maybe new to your team that wants to disagree, but isn't doing it. Have you got any kind of frameworks? How do you do that? How would you be able to maybe get somebody that doesn't understand your leadership values at the moment to be a little bit more open and start to share some of their disagreements and how you might then be able to kind of coax it out of them?
So if they're in the room, I have permission to call on them. That's the first thing, right? So that's, you know, I don't want anybody hiding in a room. So that's one of the first things I make clear to people. But the way I would do that is, okay, so I think we're heading down a very particular road. Janet, I will just make somebody up. Janet, just to make sure that we're thinking this through completely, I want you to help me come up with a completely opposite way of doing this. Tell me a completely different way of doing this. I don't care if it's right or wrong. Doesn't matter. Just tell me a completely different way of doing this to make sure that we're not locked into groupthink. So it's not that she is having to speak up on her own because she disagrees, but it's like I have created an opportunity for her to present an alternative for consideration, right? And it's getting there in a different way, right? It's almost like a debate society, right? Taking a debate society approach, right? And trying to leverage it that way.
Yeah, nice. Okay, I like that. So they then get to the thoughts that they've got in their mind. They then go, oh, well, a different way could be this. But it's actually the thing that they want to talk about that they're perhaps holding in.
Exactly. And then you also get a positive cascade effect too. Because what you might find is other people have alternative ideas as well that then comes out onto the table. And then what you've done is you've moved away from groupthink to a broader thing. Now,
yeah, nice.
The other thing that you have or the other thing that I always try and make sure that I do, because I've seen another way go horribly wrong, is the idea of getting to consensus, right? Trying to make sure that when you come out with a decision, that everybody realizes, okay, that is the decision. That's the way we're going to go. You know, we're probably going to tweak it on the way. We're going to be a learning organization. We're going to adjust as we go to make sure we capture opportunity or we overcome obstacles. But consensus does not mean that everybody has to be in lockstep agreement, right? And that's important as well. And I let people know that it's okay to disagree, right? This is the direction we're heading. And your disagreement, I'm counting on you that you might see opportunity or challenge before the rest of us. So we need you to do that. But this is the pathway, right? But it's consensus taken to extreme can result in the old adage of analysis paralysis. You're always going to be going back and I need more information. I need more information. I need more information. And you just never move forward. And I've seen that just arrest large organizations, both as a member of a large organization, I've seen it happen. But then in the CDMO space, I see it frequently, right? And again, that's where we help our clients with some of this, right? It's we also recognize by being smaller, we're a little more nimble. We're able to move a little bit faster. We kind of help them understand there's a difference between what do you need to know, what do you want to know, what would you like to know, right? Let's focus on what do you need to know to make a decision, right? And then what are the ramifications of waiting? And then the other thing is, and everybody always forgets this, one of the best learnings I ever had working in strategy was doing nothing is always an option. You know, so you got to make sure people realize that, you know, by doing nothing, you're not postponing a decision. You've actually made a decision.
Yeah, love it. Now, before we go, this has been full of some gems, some great frameworks. Also, I love the stories about some of the mentors that you've learned from. You know, good shout out to those guys as well. But what I'm interested to understand from you, Tom, is like, what do you think about the future of leadership in the life sciences? So from all of the things that you have learned, what are you thinking about next when it comes to leadership?
So I have two thoughts. One is kind of unpleasant and one is pleasant. The unpleasant thought is that probably if we accept in manufacturing that generational change happens every 5 years, right? New frontline supervisor groups generally start every 5 years as people move up the progression. Two generations after I started, we started to really over specialize. We didn't move people through different technology modalities so that they didn't get different ways of thinking. They became, you know, my background is sterile fill finish of liquid and lyo vials. It's like, okay, what about prefilled syringes? Nope, that's somebody else. What about terminal sterilization? Nope, that's somebody else too. No, this is bad. So we've got this generation or three of people that came up, but that they're highly, highly specialized, right? And I think that is going to be problematic because they don't have that general experience set that allows them, that has challenged their brain to problem solving and dealing with people in different situations across a broad set of modalities. And those modalities bring different challenges. They bring different people. And that's going to be a gap, right? And we're going to have to pay for that gap because that's our talent bench.
Yeah, succession pool, big gap.
Exactly. Now, what I'm seeing is some of that is changing again. The big MNCs are starting to recognize that they have a talent gap, or that the bench isn't as strong as it should be, right? And I think that's materializing now and I've seen it in five multinationals. They can't find site leaders. They can't find people that are good site leaders. Now, where I think things are still healthy is that the mid-size and the small shops are, because you have to wear so many hats, that I think there's a talent pool there that perhaps hasn't been properly leveraged before. So I'm hopeful that we're going to see leadership talent coming from smaller pharma into big pharma. And I think that will really help because they're not just going to bring their leadership talents, but they're going to bring new, interesting, and efficient ways of doing things, right? Which should help overcome some of the bigger bureaucracies that exist.
Yeah, hopefully. With the debt or right-sizing of some of those blue chips as well, losing some of the layers of complexity and politicalness, whatever you want to call it, that is a breakthrough. If you can go small to mid-sized talent pool and then put them into a larger organization without the shackles of the politics and stuff, that could be really exciting. So I love that. What about the future of the industry? What excites you?
Well, peptides. That's why I chose this. What excites me? I think there is, there was a lot of irrational exuberance, I think, around the idea of personal medicine and, you know, trying to get to a dosage of one. I'm not sure that we're that close to that. I think people are way out over their skis on that. I do think that precision medicine is something that is really has huge potential going forward. We saw some initial forays into that with cell and gene. I do think cell and gene forgot their, you know, first principles of business, right? They should have gone after some of the bigger disease states, not rare disease. You know, rare disease, by tackling that first, you wiped out your treatment cohort through your clinical studies. So there was nobody left to treat, or very few left to treat. So that I think that really put pressure on that space for technology that could actually work. But I think as people rethink that and go after larger disease states that could then fund further research, could support the overheads, the infrastructures that were built, that could play positive into that. Again, peptides. I think peptides are really going to be and are a new old way of looking at things, right? It's, you know, what the reason I think they're so fascinating, first of all, the success of the GLP-1s, kudos to Novo and Lilly for what they've been able to do. But it's shown people that you can approach the opportunities that biologics present in a small molecule framework, right? So your development times are much shorter. You're on an NDA pathway as opposed to a BLA pathway. I think that is really interesting. And I think the R&D potential of people working in a small shop to develop the science, the initial science, and then be able to sell it to a mid-size or large-size pharma, to then truly bring that to a successful conclusion, I think that's a great operating model. I really, that whole develop and sell model, I think has huge potential. And so much so that we're seeing it now coming out of China, right? China, everybody thought China was going to be this generic massive monster, right? On par with Team India. But and they started out that way. But what we're seeing now is the amount of innovation that's really coming out of China is spectacular, right? And then finding pathways to get that to the rest of the world, right? So yeah, the geopolitics right now, things are wackadoodle. I can't solve any of that, right? All I can solve is trying to find ways to make products to cure disease states, right? So I really could give two hoots about, you know, who hates who on any given day. I just care about how do we get those medicines to patients.
Yeah, love it. Thank you, Tom. It's been an absolute blast. I've loved the conversation. As I said, so many frameworks, some gems throughout the episode. And thank you very much for sharing your thoughts there on the future of not only leadership, but the industry. So thank you. Tom, that was brilliant. I look forward to speaking to you again.
Tom, it's a pleasure. Again, thanks for having me today. It's always fun to chat.
Cheers. Thank you.